The Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division Committee will come to order. It is Wednesday, February 11th, and members at your desks and guests in the audience on the table is assignment number 5. And I expect it to be completed by committee on Monday, and please bring it with you on Monday. We are going to go back to the compilation of assignment number 1, and we're going to use question number 2, what were your expectations? Keep in mind that they're in 3 different places in the compilation because we had 3 different age groups. So we're referring back to the expectations of the people that you interviewed, and then there's a worksheet provided, but you have to read assignment 4 first, because the worksheet that's provided talks about our committee goals and our indicators of success. So work on it. There's no right or wrong answers, but we're going to do some more work with it on Monday evening. So, and Monday evening could run longer by a whole bunch of time, maybe. Thank you so much. Today, we're going to talk about grants management in Minnesota and how we came to where we are, and the best person to tell us where we are is our legislative auditor and where we're going to, what we should be looking out for. And then after the legislative auditor, James Noble, presents, then Kristen Batson from the Office of the Grant Management from the Department of Administration will come forward, and then, depending on the time, we have some other people in the audience to talk about what they do.
Madam Chair,
welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me is Judy Randall from the Program Evaluation Division, and Cecile Perkel, who's the deputy legislative auditor for the Financial Audit Division. And we think it's very appropriate and timely for you to talk about these issues. We know that there are a lot of issues and concerns still about exactly how the state will appropriate and oversee and monitor the money from the constitutional amendment for the outdoors and other activities. And I spoke to the Heritage Council earlier in the week, and we talked about some of those issues. But I know ultimately those issues will have to come before legislative committees and the legislature as a whole for resolution. And so we appreciate this opportunity to talk to you. The state, as you well know, utilizes nonprofit organizations and other units of government a great deal to accomplish its objectives, and often that is done through grants. The state gives money to accomplish specific purposes. And we do not, in the Office of the Legislative Auditor, go out by design and audit grants. But from time to time, we've addressed the issue in several different ways. First, back in 2006, we were asked to assess just how well grants are managed on the state side of the equation. And Judy Randall was the manager of that evaluation, and we issued this report. And I think one of the good things to say is that this report, although it certainly pointed to some problems in the state's management of grants, the legislature responded and the executive branch responded, and there is now an Office of Grants Management, which we think has brought some good reform to the state's responsibilities. And Judy Randall will talk to you in just a minute about the problems that we found and some of the solutions that are now in process, and then you have someone from the Office of Grants Management who can talk to you in more detail about that. So that will kind of give you the big picture from, again, the state side of the equation. But as I said, we do not on a regular basis go out and audit grants from the perspective of how the recipients of the grant utilize the money. But on occasion, we do on an ad hoc basis because allegations are raised that a private nonprofit organization has possibly inappropriately used state money. And so we have looked over the years at several organizations that have been the recipients of grants from the state, and we have found problems. And I think that those reports can give us some warning signs of things we want to avoid in the future. And Cecile Ferkel has worked in some detail on those, and she's going to tell you about some of the issues that we have found and some of the solutions that we see for those problems. So, Madam Chair, if we could start with Judy Randall giving you what we found in our evaluation on, again, on the state side of the process.
Thank you. Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall, and I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And as Mr. Noble said, in 2006, we reviewed the state's approach to making grants and overseeing grants to nonprofit organizations. And we had a couple of broad overarching findings. The first one was that the state's approach to managing grants to nonprofits was fragmented and inconsistent, and in many cases didn't provide adequate accountability. Now, as Mr. Knowles mentioned, as you'll hear later, and Ms. Batson is here to talk about it from the Office of Grants Management, we think a number of those issues have been addressed by the creation of the Office of Grants Management, which now is putting out policies to have a more statewide, cohesive approach to managing grants. And I'll let her give you the details on that. So that was kind of on the policy aspect. We also looked in depth at 45 grants that were made by several of the large state agencies in the state, and we found that the actual practices that were used to manage and oversee those grants really varied, not only from agency to agency, but also within an agency. So one division in DHS had one set of grant practices, and another division within DHS had another set of grant practices. And just to kind of give you a sense of some of the different things we saw, I'll just throw out some of the facts we found. Half of the grants, or less than half of the grants we reviewed, were awarded through a competitive process. Two of the grants we reviewed, two out of 45, didn't have a written grant agreement or a contract with the recipient, which means then that they didn't have in place, you know, all of the standard language that the state wants in place when it has a contract, things like liability and data practices protection and all of those factors. Over half of the grants we reviewed, there was no site visit, no formal monitoring or site visit of the recipient to make sure that what was supposed to be happening was happening. And in about a quarter, a little over a quarter of the grants we reviewed, the staff did not review the financial aspect of the grant. So they didn't ensure that the money was being used appropriately and for what it was intended. And some of the grants that we reviewed were paid in full in advance. So we thought that there were a lot of kind of holes here in terms of oversight and state staff who are responsible for managing these grants, making sure that the state is getting what it was expecting to get. The other big area that we found was that those grants that were where the grantee was named in law, so where it was a legislatively named grantee, had especially weak oversight. And in many of the ones that we reviewed, the agency staff who were responsible for administering that grant said, well, what does it matter? I don't have any control over this anyways. These grantees are guaranteed in law to get the money, so why should I bother, you know, having them set up a work plan, or why should I bother doing the regular site visits, because they're guaranteed the money in law. So we found especially weak oversight for grantees that were named in law. And some recommendations to address that, I would note that the Office of Grants Management has put out a policy that states any grantees named in law should be held to the same standards as all the other grantees that have gone through competitive processes and others. But also one thing that might be relevant as the committee moves forward is to think about putting some requirements in law where you've named a grantee. So if you choose to name a specific recipient of grant money, you know, not necessarily just saying, here's $1 million for XYZ organization, but saying, you know, here's $1 million for XYZ organization, that should be either monitored in accordance with the Office of Grant Management policies. That would be one way to do it. Or here's $1 million for XYZ organization, and, you know, whatever agency is receiving the money should make sure that they're meeting the expectations of the award or something like that. So we addressed that point. I think that point might be the most relevant for this committee to consider going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Randall. Ms. Perkel?
Good morning. I'm Cecile Perkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor in the Financial Audit Division. And as a part of our regular audits that we do with state agencies, we often look at grant payments that they're making to other organizations. And so there's a level of oversight that we expect to see at a department level. But then on a few occasions, because of some concerns about good financial management by a grantee, we have looked specifically further down the line at the grantee's operations. So I want to talk also about some of the things we've seen there. In a state agency, when they have a grant program, what we're looking for is that they are not only watching that the mission of the grant or the purpose of the grant is being accomplished, but that the money that has been given to the grantee is being used appropriately. Oftentimes a grant agreement will say that a certain percentage is overhead or administrative costs are limited to a certain percentage. So we'll test to see whether or not they are including only appropriate costs in that part, and that the rest of the funds have to be used for other purposes. We're also looking to see what kinds of support they're providing for their costs. And sometimes what we see is that they're submitting a quarterly invoice that's maybe for 1/4 of the annual amount that they're supposed to get. And that right away to us is a red flag that they're not really requesting reimbursement for actual costs. Sometimes they'll list out a few things, but it'll be clear that it's a allocation of the budgeted amount. It's like 1 month's worth of the salary amount they had budgeted rather than the actual amount of payroll expenditures that they had or the actual amount of other kinds of costs that they have. What we're looking for and what most of the grant agreements expect is that they are requesting reimbursement for actual costs they have incurred. And so when we go out and do audits, that's what we're looking for. Sometimes we find, though, that the state agency personnel, they're looking more for outcomes and accomplishments, and they're not looking in as much detail at the actual costs that are being reported. There was one agency we encountered in the last year and a half or so that was doing such a good job that it actually was inhibiting the program, though. There's grant funds that go out to people that want to make movies in the state of Minnesota, and the oversight by the film board was so strong that they required receipts for absolutely everything and that all receipts be submitted, including McDonald's lunches by the film crew. And they would get stacks of documentation of invoices that were this thick, and they were months behind in providing reimbursement to the film companies. And the film companies were late in providing the invoices as well because it was hard to compile all of that information. I think that actually was such strong oversight that it was disincentive to the program. So there is a balance, and certainly state agencies have the right and the option and I think the obligation to follow through sometimes and ask for actual documentation and ask for actual receipts and actual evidence that these costs have been incurred. So again, that oversight by the state agency and a definition and expectation to the grantee of what that oversight is going to consist of, I think is really important. On the few occasions when we've gone to the grantee level and looked at their operations, again, that has happened when there have been concerns about the expenditures. Somebody has raised a red flag and said we need to look at that. One of those organizations was the Women's Advocates. It was money that was being granted out through the Department of Public Safety for safe shelter for battered women. It was an organization that was really achieving its goals, really doing a good job, but at a certain point in the early years of its operations, the people that were running their home made a lot of personal sacrifices in terms of hours worked without compensation or low compensation. And as the home got more financially stable, what we saw was they felt that they were entitled to more compensation than what the compensation plan allowed. And the executive director granted raises to herself, granted higher contributions to her 401k, and we think in an attempt to not cause concern about that internally with her staff, she also gave her staff bonuses and gave them additional compensation into their 401ks. So you know, it was just really interesting as you got into it, because these were very committed, very dedicated people who had really served the community and a really deserving community, and yet at a certain point they felt that it was their turn to get some of the compensation. Another one that we looked at was the African American Mentorship Program. I think it was a great idea where a high school teacher found college students, African American college students, who would mentor African American high school students to encourage them to stick with their academics and help them see that there's life beyond high school and get into college. And I think it was really a great plan. One of the things we found as we dug into this more was that although on information submitted to the state and on information even submitted to the Secretary of State, there were identified board members that oversaw this organization. As we contacted some of those board members, they had no idea that the organization existed or that they were part of the board. So there was some right up front kind of poor intentions about what was going to happen. And as we looked at the invoices and the receipts that were submitted by the executive director who ran this program, we saw restaurants at like Pino Latino's, and the receipt would be time stamped at 1 a.m. and, it's more than just a few of these things. Rentals of tuxedos so that he could go to the prom and represent them, which seems certainly like a personal expense. One of the things that really was, really concerning to us as we found it was that on one day he gave himself a $7,000, wrote himself out a $7,000 check, and we were able to match that up with the day that he closed on a house. So clearly he was using the resources that have been provided. Again, there's a lack of oversight by the department in what they're watching, how this money is spent. I think especially when you get into some of these programs where you're really committed to a cause and you're really doing a good job for the community, that also provides an opportunity for someone to take advantage of that on the financial side. And the board really, I think one of the things as you're making grants, to know that there really is a board, and the board really is involved in not only the oversight of the operations in terms of the services they're providing, but also some accountability for the money they're spending and how they're spending it, and that they're holding that executive director accountable for those expenses.
Holy cow.
Madam Chair,
excuse me, sure. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the witness here. You kind of drew some red flags with me when you said something about how you could, be some overkill on making them do too much. How could there possibly be too much? I mean, I can't imagine issuing a check to someone without having a receipt approved for the expenditure. And you said, like, McDonald's, and they were way behind. Well, that sounds like sloppy accounting to me. I would think a grant that every penny that was spent would be accounted for through a receipt or an invoice or something like that.
It's a miracle, Madam Chair. What we would be comfortable with from an audit standpoint is that there's evidence that they're submitting requests for reimbursements of actual expenses. And, there are some just really easy ways to do that. I mean, if they're asking for $10,000 even, no extra cents, it's pretty clear that they're not using actual expenses. But then beyond that, we do expect that the department is doing some accountability with them. Maybe once a month, on 1 month out of the claims, maybe they say, well, provide us with your payroll roster and show us the evidence for that. But to require that every single, the requirement is that everything needs to be actual expenses, but to require that every single receipt be submitted to the state agency is really onerous in many of these cases. And when we were at the film board, they did tell us that some people were turning away from their grant dollars because they did not feel that they wanted to comply with that heavy administrative overload.
Well, Madam Chair, and to the witness, how is that a heavy administrative overload? I mean, before you get a reimbursement, you've got to get a receipt. Or are you saying they'd have the receipt to the agency, but they don't give it to the state agency or win it through?
Yes, that's it.
Madam Chair, and if I might add, President Davis, I think this is an excellent discussion because I think it points out exactly in detail what level of accountability documentation do you want. I would point out, for example, that the way many organizations, including the state of Minnesota for its employees, does not require an actual receipt for a meal because the state provides a fixed amount. Now, some organizations can add to that and require a receipt, but the state policy is you have a fixed amount for breakfast, you have a fixed amount for lunch, you have a fixed amount for dinner. The legislature, I think, in its plan has a similar provision for its employees. So there is accountability. You have to show that, in fact, your meal was related to an official function. You were on business. But, again, there are a variety of ways to sort out what level of documentation and reporting and accounting you want. But if I could just pick up, too, on some of the things that Ms. Ferkel said, because I think she really raises something that you need to think about, and I think the Outdoor Heritage Council needs to think about, too. Because you're going to have a lot of people coming to you that are private nonprofit organizations with a lot of good ideas. Just like Ms. Ferkel said, people very committed to do good things. But you're going to have to sort out how strong and viable is that organization financially already before you provide it with money. Is it an organization that will depend totally on state money? Or does it have some viability and some proven record of accomplishment and financial viability, and you want to build on that? Or is this just a startup? I mean, we have seen in some grants that the organization is literally in somebody's basement, and it's depending on the state grant and only the state grant. That's all it's got. That's a much weaker organization to really accomplish what you want. So I think you're going to have strong organizations, proven organizations. You're going to have others that have great ideas but haven't really proven themselves to be effective and financially viable. And I'm not quite sure, Madam Chair and members, exactly where that sorting out is going to occur, whether it's going to be at the Heritage Council, whether it's going to be here at the legislature, whether you're going to appropriate a certain amount of money to a state agency or some other nonprofit to sort that out. So, as I said before, speaking to the Outdoor Council on Monday, speaking to others who are involved in that, I think those are a lot of the questions, sort of big questions, and then down to Representative David, some of the more granular questions that need to be sorted out by somebody at some point, and whether it's you or whether it's the state agency that has some administrative responsibility for the grant, all of these things are better sorted out at the beginning, rather than somebody being asked to produce the receipts for the meal and they say, well, we had no idea that that was your expectation. So all of these things need to be sorted out sooner rather than later.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to our auditors who always give us good insights. I'm wondering whether in your oversight you feel like there needs to be or there's justification for a different standard of oversight when it's grants to, say, a local government where you're already, they're subject to state audit, they've got established, approved accounting standards, those sorts of things, as opposed to a startup nonprofit. You know, sometimes I think grants to governmental entities are actually more about transferring of funds and an established relationship rather than a grant program. And the second question is, like, are you aware of any good models of oversight or coaching that you could point us to? Because there will be some organizations that are small that would like to grow big, and we all can probably name some organizations that have done very well in that growth pattern and others that have stumbled. And I'm wondering whether we ought to consider some oversight coaching sort of roles if we're going to be initiating a lot of that growth in certain sectors.
Madam Chair and members, two very good questions. Again, things that need to be sorted out. Should there be a different level of accountability and oversight for grants to government organizations? I think you can make a case for that, but I think there are still some issues that remain. For example, if you give a grant, let's say $1 million or $10 million to Hennepin County, just to pick an example, what cost should be chargeable to that grant? How much rent? How much overhead? So I think you never get away from the question of what are appropriate costs to be allocated to that grant. I would, for example, mention we recently, and some of you I think were there, at a committee talked about the GO bonds. And that issue comes up when you give an organization money from general obligation bonds. How much of their management, general management of facilities management, for example, should they be able to charge to money that you give them to build a building? We had that issue, for example, at the University of Minnesota and at Minsky. They have an ongoing Office of Facilities Management. Periodically, they get GO bonds. How much of the salary cost for maintaining that office? Representative Hausman heard this hearing, and it's an issue. And I think it will be the same issue with grants. So, yes, I think we can assume that most cities, counties, school districts, other units of government have probably some increased or greater level of oversight and accountability than a nonprofit. They have the state auditor's office auditing them or a CPA firm. But there's still some issues that need to be specified and sorted out. On your question about a model, and we agree that sometimes the best ideas come from the startup smaller organizations, and you don't want to pass them by. So how to help them grow? And what I would suggest you do, and Judy Randall may want to comment on this too, because when we did the evaluation of grants management, we wanted to know how some of the large private organizations that have large endowments and distribute money to other organizations through grants, McKnight Foundation, Bush Foundation, some of those, many of the United Way. Many of those organizations are in the business of having a sizable amount of money and then achieving their objectives by grants to other organizations. And oftentimes those organizations really do want to help startup organizations. So I would suggest you talk to some of them. Judy actually, as a part of our evaluation, went out and talked to some of those organizations about their policies.
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. We spoke with McKnight Foundation and the Bush Foundation members about their grant-making policies. But in terms of kind of incubating smaller nonprofit organizations and getting them up to a place where they would be in a position to have enough control and adequate oversight so that they would be eligible for a state grant, you know, the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits really provides a lot of services to that effect and to help smaller nonprofit organizations. And I don't know if Ms. Batson might have some insight as well into things that the state is doing to provide information on how a nonprofit organization could access state grants. And so I think that's something, I don't know that it's the state's role to, you know, really help these organizations develop, but certainly the state has an interest in at least making its own process accessible and understandable for some of those smaller organizations to access the grants. And then as Mr. Noble said, some of those larger foundations, you know, they have really excellent grant-making policies and oversight. They tend to do a lot more on the front end in terms of making sure that they're giving out the grant to somebody who can achieve the purpose and really achieve what they want to do. I don't think they have as much ongoing oversight as we would expect from a state grant.
Okay. Ms. Walker?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Nobles, and I apologize for being late, but just on the question of grants to nonprofits, and maybe council could weigh in as well, is there anything in existing statute right now that says the state cannot give a direct grant to a nonprofit? Is there any, I'm just looking at guidance in existing statute, not any new statute, because on Monday we heard a number of requests that were specific direct grants to nonprofits.
Madam Chair and members, this is an issue that we have researched, and certainly Council, Mark Shepherd, can add to this, but it is our understanding that there is no specific requirement in the Minnesota Constitution that would prohibit that. There is language that prohibits the state from extending its credit to a private entity. But can you appropriate money directly to a private entity? It appears that there is no clear statutory or a constitutional restriction or case law restriction that I'm aware of, nor statutory. But what I've been told both by Senate counsel, and I think we confirm this with Mr. Shepherd as well, that the legislature has a practice, not a formal written policy that we're aware of, but I think the state and the legislature has had a practice of not appropriating money directly to nonprofits because they do want some oversight through a state agency. Now, as Ms. Randall said, when the legislature names the entity, what we found is that state agencies are not quite as rigorous in their oversight, and I think that needs to be corrected. But again, we're not aware of a clear policy legal restriction, but I think we would, as an office, strongly suggest that you continue with your practice of utilizing a state agency for oversight, but where you choose to appropriate directly, and it's our understanding that it has been done. It's not totally unprecedented. There is a practice not to do it, but there have been exceptions. But if you choose to do that for whatever reason, again, I think you have to find some mechanism of accountability, of reporting, of accounting for both what was achieved and how the money was spent.
Representative Virginia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the issues that I have run into on the LCCMR, and I suspect we're going to see more of it, is the exploding practice of purchasing easements. And we have the state agency, DNR, purchasing easements, and at this point, they don't know where all their easements are, they don't know what their easements give them, and we obviously don't go out and do monitoring and, you know, enforcement. They're trying to now find out where all their easements are. So they're working on it. But there's another segment of what happens. It's not just direct DNR purchase. It's a nonprofit purchasing an easement, then giving the easement to a local unit of government, giving it to DNR, or keeping it themselves. And I see two issues, and I just want to see if you can help us with some policies here. One is how they're restored, because generally they're supposed to be restored. How do we check up on that? And secondly, how do we check up on making sure that there is the money to monitor this? These are permanent, forever, essentially. Have you all grappled with that yet?
Madam Chair and members, as an issue, I guess as a policy issue, we looked at the use of easements for a variety of environmental and land preservation issues. But I think you're really addressing more the accounting, and I guess all I can say from what you just said, sounds like we need to do a better record-keeping job at the state agency and possibly at the local level. I don't know what else on that I can offer. I would just, though, take your point on LCCMR. I mean, again, I think what that model presents versus the Outdoor Heritage Council presents to you is how much of that oversight, accounting, record-keeping do you want to occur at the legislative branch, which the LCCMR, I think it's my correct understanding, is considered to be a commission within the legislative branch, and it has, over the years, I think, had a very excellent staff that has done a good deal of oversight and record-keeping, limited because of the limitations of the staff. But it's my understanding that the Outdoor Heritage Council is kind of at a point of wondering, and there are issues about whether or not there is going to be a staff for that council, whether they would, for example, have that as one of their responsibilities. As this money goes out and maybe buys easements or grants to accomplish other things, is it the Outdoor Heritage Council that is going to have a staff and do that kind of record-keeping accountability? Is it going to be in DNR, which now is providing the administrative support staff? So I think you point to a very good issue, but again, I think it's one of those loose ends that needs to be tied up as we take advantage of this great opportunity of this large sum of money to do good things.
Representative Virginia.
Just to follow up, I think we have these three. Some go to DNR, and we can give DNR oversight and say, okay, you've got to do a better job here. When they go to local units of government, well, I think we can track up. But when an easement is kept by a nonprofit, Are there some requirements we should have that that nonprofit has a certain amount of money set aside for long-term management, or do we have any guidelines for that? That one I just, I'm at a loss for.
Mr. Noble.
Madam Chair and members, I'm at a loss too to know exactly, but I think it's an excellent thing to think through. I know in there are jurisdictions where nonprofits have really been the major force for buying easements to preserve land from development. But you may want to utilize some of those nonprofits. I think they exist in Minnesota as well. And they may apply to you for state money to further their purchasing of those easements. So a record keeping, I think, is an issue. But also, I think there would be an issue of ownership and transferability. This nonprofit, we would hope not, but potentially could at some point in time not exist. Who has the ownership interest in that easement that was bought possibly with state money? I think that's an issue that really needs to be considered and resolved before you give them the money.
Representative Kahn.
Chairman, in a previous life, when I received grants, every one of those grants had an indirect cost allotment, which was absolutely specified, and before applying for the grant, you knew what that indirect cost allotment is. And I wondered if that's a month, and it was negotiated with the university. They actually negotiated different, if someone did a pretty strong, it was a pretty high level, and it covered everything, including administrative expenses and secretarial help and things like that. It was what was interesting was that different entities negotiated different amounts. This is a really long time ago, but I'm sure it's still true. American Cancer Society had a much more beneficial amount than the federal agencies, the NIH and the National Science Foundation. But I think the idea of setting an indirect cost, you know, level that could be considered a maximum would be a good idea. And the other thing that's done is that LCCMR, I actually think this applies to in state law too, but I'm not sure that anyone else does it as well as LCCMR does. They have a peer review process for anything that requires scientific research or something else. The section that deals with environmental restoration and water pollution may have some of that aspect to it. I'm not sure if it does. But I think you ought to check with LCCMR about how they've done their peer review process
and
things getting outside.
Who are the peers?
So they're chosen by LCCMR, by the staff. They're some, you know, active or retired scientists. I think they, Representative Virginia probably knows more about it than me now about how it's working. They're people who are working in the field, but not connected with the grant that they're looking at.
And are they volunteers?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh. They may get expenses paid, I don't know.
Marvelous. Mr. Nobles, have you ever done anything evaluating where the peer review process has been used?
Yes, Madam Chair, and it's used in a variety of ways, and I think that always brings some expertise and some independence and objectivity in making these assessments. But I think as it's structured now, you've established this Outdoor Heritage Council to some degree to be that review process. Whether they would want to bring in some peers on specific reviews, I think is something that would, particularly in areas that are somewhat complex in scientific research, that council may not currently have people on it that would be in a position to do that. But Representative Kahn, I think, brings up a point I just want to say again, and it refers back to what Representative Wagenius was raising in terms of these easements. There are some grants that can result in a product, in either a copyrighted or a potential patented product. And again, if this is done through a state grant, there needs to be some specification of the ownership rights. And I know at the university they have a fairly well-developed process and specification. If a professor receives a grant through a a commercial interest or a nonprofit interest, but it comes through the university, the university very clearly specifies the share of property rights that or property rights that will be shared among the various interests.
Representative Hawks.
A point of clarity for the use of a nonprofit for easements and protection of natural areas and park areas and stuff. They have been very beneficial for short-term holds. So when the government or the public money is waiting to move in, and it takes time to move it in, that the open market might take that land out, or the price might go up, or whatever it is. The nonprofits have been very good at protecting and holding that land, so government then can pick it up at the original price, and it's not gone. So I know that they're beneficial in that area.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Earlier I was going to make a comment to Representative Davis, if he remembers at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, when they're moving the ark through the crates and the salt mines, those boxes are full of the receipts.
Necessary for the grant.
That's good for all of us to know, isn't it?
But I did have a serious question following up on Representative Kahn's point on indirect costs, because the question about if you need to go through a state government agency as a fiscal agent, and I, having worked in the state government agency and seeing that there's state law for a indirect cost, a state of Minnesota indirect cost, and then an agency indirect cost, but the aggregate indirect cost could be up to 20% or 30%. And that, if I think I'm correct on that, right, Mr. Noble?
Well, Mr. Chair, there is certainly a complex process for allocating indirect costs, which come both from the federal government and other sources as well. And the exact percent of it, we'd have to look at that. But that, you, did you say 30%?
Well, it's the aggregate when you take the agency, Mr. The agency indirect, or the, you have an agency indirect cost, and I see there's some agency folks here. 2% from DNR, and then the state indirect cost.
Mm-hmm.
You aggregate that together, you could be pretty high. I remember some of the indirect costs on grants that I had to get, it was up in the 20% to 30% that would come off. So my question is, if we are appropriating through a fiscal aid using an outdoor heritage fund or a parks and trails fund or an arts and cultural history fund, do we have statute? Are we going to have an indirect cost taken off the top of that appropriation if it goes into the agency, a regular indirect and then an agency indirect, just under existing law, or do we need to do something? I mean, I think that we have the constitutional language that gives people want projects done, whether they're an art project, a history project, a trails project,
water
project. You know, so are they thinking of an aggregate indirect cost coming off on that goes to the agency? What statutes do we have right now in basic administration where indirect costs may come off the grant? We could probably debate yes or no on those indirect costs, but I want to know what we have right now that's going to kick in here if we're going to be doing appropriations.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, I think it's an excellent question. I think we should do some research on it. I think there would need to be probably some specification as to whether or not indirect costs would apply to these grants. I mean, some of this gets into what fund is it coming out of, and is this considered general fund money? Although it is dedicated to a certain purpose, coming as it does from the sales tax, I mean, I think you raised some good questions that need some research, because without the clarity and specification, I think agencies will wonder. I mean, can they charge indirect costs to these grants? But again, just to emphasize the bigger point, that these are the sort of very granular issues that you need to get into and resolve. And Ms. Merkel.
Representative Hansen, one of the things that I would caution against, though, is assuming that all those indirect costs don't provide some benefit back to the grant itself. If we do want state agencies to provide oversight for these grant funds, and we do want them to dedicate staff to do a good job of assessing whether or not those grantees are viable entities and are using the resources well, we do want them to be providing oversight and going on site visits. Those are the kinds of costs that the indirect costs will pay for. So I really would, although indirect costs kind of sound like taking it off the top, the agencies do need some funding for those kinds of services that they're going to provide. If you're going to give them $10 million or $20 million or more to distribute to nonprofits, that requires some work. And if they're going to do it well, it's going to cost some money.
But, Madam Chair, I would just say that, and again, we'll work out what the numbers actually are, but in the 20 to 30% range sounds very high to me. We work with indirect costs too, and I don't think we would take that.
Well, Mr. Soderbergh keeps telling me at every meeting that I have, everything costs money. And what we call it, administrative costs or indirect costs or whatever we call it, this committee is going to have to come to some kind of a understanding of what we will stand for.
But Madam Chair,
I would appreciate it if you would go back and do some further research on that, because this is a major thing that we're going to have to answer.
We indeed will, but just again, to put this back on the table in terms of, yes, they're going to need money, but you don't have to leave it up to indirect costs to cover that. I mean, you in many instances can directly appropriate money, or you can specify how much from other funds they could use. So indirect cost gets to be a very complicated kind of a financial way to do this. We actually do some audit work in indirect costs. Federal government is very watchful, for example, of what gets allocated to indirect costs for its money, and it gets quite complicated. You can certainly use indirect costs as a mechanism for covering some of the expenses that are very legitimate expenses. But there are other ways to do it where you would have probably a much more transparent, a much more visible, and a much more direct way to control exactly how much can be taken from the grant for those expenses.
And we really want to be transparent when we come to our conclusion. Be able to follow through. Thank you very much. Is there anything in summary?
No, just thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. It's been very, very helpful. Ms. Batson, Office of Grants Management.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kristen Batson. I'm the Director of the Minnesota Office of Grants Management. The office began operations in September 2007 after the 2007 legislature created the office with a mission to do two things, really. One is to standardize, streamline, and improve state grant making across executive branch agencies, and the other is to increase public access to information about state grants. We are a Drive to Excellence initiative, one of the 13 current Drive to Excellence projects. And we were in part established because of the Office of Legislative Auditor program evaluation on state grants for nonprofits. We have a lot of partners in this work. We work actively with 30 executive branch agencies that have grant-making responsibilities. We partner very closely with the Minnesota Council on Nonprofits, the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and the Minnesota Council on Foundations. I'm here today to talk to you about the minimum standards and policies for state grant making that the office has been charged with creating. In the past 15 months, we have finalized 11 policies on state grant making, and we have two that are still in final draft form. Now, I realize not everyone is as passionate about grant making policies and procedures as I am, so I'll try to keep this at a high level and keep moving. But the first policy that we created is
one on a grant conflict of interest. And this policy requires anyone who is participating in a grant review to sign off on a conflict of interest form to either state whether they have a conflict, in that case they'll be removed from that particular review, or to state that they have no conflict with that particular set of grant applications. The second policy asks agencies to establish rating criteria for competitive grant review and to, if possible, use a numeric rating system so that we are ensuring a fair process of grant review by giving great precision in how one application is rated against another. The third policy requires that agencies publicize their grants notices or requests for proposals and includes adequate information in those so that potential grant applicants can make an informed decision about whether they're a good candidate for that grant program and can use their time wisely. A lot of our nonprofit partners are undergoing budget cuts, and their staff time is very precious, and we need to be respectful of that in how we post grant opportunities so that they can make an informed decision. The fourth policy requires the use of grant agreements. Judy Randall from the Office of the Legislative Auditor said that in their program evaluation they found a few incidents where grant agreements were not used, and that really is a baseline requirement. We need to have the terms of the grant in a grant agreement so that everyone can sign off on the conditions of the grant. The fifth policy, one of the requirements of the enabling legislation for the Office of Grants Management is that we take public complaints about potential fraud and waste in state grants. So the fifth policy describes how we'll do that and how we work with agencies to make sure that those complaints are investigated fully. The sixth policy requires that when we're making a grant of over $25,000 to a non-governmental organization, we look at recent financial statements from that organization to ensure that they're financially healthy. And we're really looking at two things in this policy. One is income to expenses, and the other is their level of net assets. We want to make sure that we're not making grants to organizations that are in danger of going out of business quickly. We also have written a policy on single and sole source grants. There are instances in which it is appropriate for a state agency to make a single and sole source grant. If there is only one potential grantee that is conceivably able to do the work, we can then make a single or sole source grant without using a competitive process. But in the vast majority of cases, we need to be using a competitive process for the award of grant dollars. We also need to be requesting progress reports on state grants at least annually. Twice a year, in most cases, is preferred, but there are some reasons where annually is practical. And that's really where we can be assured that we are seeing the outcomes from these grant dollars. That really is what we're after and what these grants are all about. Agencies are also required to conduct monitoring visits on grants of over $50,000 once per grant period, and to conduct at least annual monitoring visits on grants of over $250,000, where our exposure to risk is significantly higher. And this gives the grant manager a chance to check in with the agency, with the grantee, and make sure that the grant is on track for producing the sort of outcomes that we were looking for. We are also requiring agencies to do a financial reconciliation of grantees' expenditures at least once in a grant period on grants of over $50,000. And that's where we're spot checking to make sure that there's backup for all the requests for reimbursement and that matches out. The staff in the Office of the Legislative Auditor talked about legislatively mandated grants. Policy 0811 says that state agencies must manage legislatively mandated grants with the same level of oversight that they would with any other grant, while still respecting and maintaining the legislative intent, of course. In situations in which the purpose and the amount of a grant is stated in law, but the grantee organization is not necessarily named,
then we must either use a single sole source process or a competitive process for that. And policy 0812 says that because we're using grant agreements as the guiding documents for our grant making, if we're making changes to that grant, we need to do that through a fully executed grant amendment. There are two policies that are in final draft form and should be released within the next couple months. First is policy on grant payments. Reimbursement is the preferred method for making grant payments. And we really need to do a better job of reviewing those requests for reimbursement and making sure that those requests are appropriate and that the grantee is on track with outcomes and meeting the goals of the grant as we make those payments. And then the last policy is a policy on grant closeout evaluation. It says that state agencies, as they're closing out a grant, after the grant period has ended, must write a short evaluation of, did the grant meet its goals? Was the money managed appropriately? Were the terms of the grant agreement complied with? And that that information must be electronically available within that state agency so that if that particular grantee should apply for money again, we can easily access that information about past performance. The office, also, I'd like to draw your attention to two websites that the office has created. One is for potential grantees or anyone who's seeking a grant from the state, and that's www.grants.state.mn.us, and that's a portal that links to all competitive grant opportunities with the state of Minnesota.
In all 30 agencies?
In 21 agencies. Not all state agencies have competitive grant opportunities. Some only make formula grants.
Thank you.
And we also created a resource website for state agency staff that work with grants, where we have statute and policy posted, best practices, training and professional development opportunities, training materials, so on and so forth. And we're constantly adding information to that site as we build it. I also wanted to mention today that training for nonprofit grantees was brought up earlier, and the Office of Grants Management partners closely with the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits to provide training to grantees about what is required of an organization to be a successful state grantee. There really is a difference when you're receiving money from the government about how you track labor, how you track money, and how you track outcomes. We have high expectations for grant awards in those areas. And so we have made ourselves very available to the Council of Nonprofits to provide that sort of training. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Barton. That's for Bastion, excuse me. Have we evolved, or are there models of state agencies that have evolved to performance-based, you know, contracting as opposed to a, you know, just a grant award with, you know, past performance audit asked to see if they've achieved kind of the broad purpose goals? I've heard that that's sort of an evolving sort of approach, and I just wondered.
Ms. Batson?
I believe that we have, and I believe, although I'm not 100% sure, that in areas of workforce development, workforce training, they are farther along the curve towards performance-based contracting.
Are you going to push it?
I don't know. I would have to research that more. There are 754 different grant programs in state government currently, and they are all unique. So you really need to look at each program on its own merits and where we can have the best chance of receiving the outcomes that we seek.
754?
Yes.
Ms. Batson?
Yes.
Holy cow. Among 30 agencies.
Mm-hmm. And all have different goals, different funding streams, different processes.
Oh, my. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Batson. Just reading the grant, or your sheet here, which is very, very good. It does say that you were established through a one-time appropriation. So Will your office exist after June 30th this year?
We are currently in the governor's budget for the next biennium.
That didn't answer the question.
And Ms. Batson, is there more than you in your office?
No, it's just a one-person staff.
And were you in the Department of Administration before?
No, I am new to the Department of Administration and to state government. I come from private philanthropy.
Oh, did you bring a picture?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Another time. Another time. Any other questions, Ms. Batson? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Is anyone from the Minnesota Budget Project here? We issued a very tardy request. No, but we received in our mail one day in the last 3 days something that looks like this from the Minnesota Budget Project. And in the budget project, one of the first papers to come up were their five priorities for a better budget process. And I think it would be wise to read through that and see what you think before you do just the assignment that I gave today. And or in addition to the reading assignment that we've had for today. And maybe take this out and put it with your materials for this committee. Because I think responsibility and fiscal management has been stressed by both speakers before us. Clear lines of accountability, transparency, flexibility to respond to short-term challenges, exactly what Representative Haas is talking about. Good financial information, and that came from the auditor. And stability in the decision-making process. There's good things to hang on to, I think. I asked for an example of some comments from the McKnight Foundation, and that too was a kind of a late request, but Vicki Benson is here to just very, very briefly talk about their partnerships. And Vicki Benson heads the art program at the McKnight Foundation, and the McKnight Foundation is one of the big contributors partnerships to the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Council. And the reason I thought about this was because I read in the Duluth paper last week about the awarding of grants in the Arrowhead region. And I thought, oh, the McKnight Foundation is a major partner. And I thought, let's hear about that. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And committee members, thank you for inviting me here today to talk about McKnight's relationship with the Regional Arts Council. As you know, the McKnight Foundation is the largest foundation in Minnesota. Up until the recent economic slide, it held $1.2 billion and in one fell swoop lost $700 million in the recent quarter, which is typical, as I know you know, of most of foundations in the state and in the country. But nonetheless, McKnight Foundation in the past year made grants of $100 million, and of that $100 million, 10% is appropriated to the arts, and that is the program that I direct. And our mission within the arts is to support professional artwork across the state, as well as access for every Minnesotan to quality arts. And without the help of the Regional Arts Councils, we would not be able to meet that mission. So for
a very long time, the McKnight Foundation has made grants to the 11 regional arts councils in the state. And the process is that the regional arts councils, which are nonprofits, make an application each year to the McKnight Foundation to re-grant McKnight's funds in order to help us meet our mission and the Regional Arts Council's mission. And the Regional Arts Councils, we feel, are the best to handle this re-granting process because they have been in existence for, in many cases, more than 30 years. They know their regions. They have great processes for panel processes for selecting the grantees from the applicant pools that they receive. And each of the 11 regional arts councils have different programs. So, for example, in your region, Madam Chair, the McKnight funds are re-granted to nonprofit arts organizations, individual artists for both fellowship reasons and for professional development reasons, to arts organizations to help them build their capacity, their administrative capacity. And each year at the close of the grant process, we receive, I brought from your region an example, we receive a complete report of every single dollar that is spent of McKnight's funds and every single individual artist that receives grants, how much they received, and every organization, their organization's mission, and the amount of grant dollars that they received. And I work very closely with all 11 Regional Arts Council directors. And the 12th grant that we make, actually, is to the Forum of Regional Arts Councils, which is a separate nonprofit that is made up of all of the 11 Regional Arts Council directors, so that they have an organization for which to network and meet with each other to share ideas and information about their work across the state. And they come together on a monthly basis to meet, and oftentimes I am at those meetings as well as the director of the state arts council, the arts board, Sue Jens. I know that the regional arts council's directors are very careful about how they spend McKnight's dollars because I'm in contact with them constantly. And because of that, I also talk with them all about how they appropriate the state's funds. So they, in addition to McKnight dollars, they receive, as you know, state funds through block grants through the Minnesota State Arts Board. And I know that the oversight for those grants that they re-grant are as high as the oversight that they bring to the McKnight dollars.
Very good. Ms. Benson, does McKnight participate in partnerships with other nonprofits or other state agencies?
Not in the arts program.
But in other programs,
yes.
Is it mainly human services?
Human services and the Recent and Communities program at McKnight oversees housing and transportation. So there are many, many collaborative agreements between McKnight and government agencies through that program. But this is the only one through the arts program.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Ms. Benson, and thank you so much for McKnight for investing all across the state of Minnesota. I was just wondering, how do you decide how to allocate your dollars? You know, the level of amount that you give, is it an equal amount per region? Is it per capita? Is it based on how many amateur versus professional artists in an area? I mean, how did you approach that task, or maybe it was all set up before you even came on and to run the program?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. It was set up before I came to McKnight. I came to McKnight about a year and a half ago, but I have a long history of grant making. Went to McKnight from the Jerome Foundation in St. Paul. The way it's decided is by the size of region. So all of the councils do not have the same number of counties that they serve. It's by size of region, and it is by number of artists. So the regional arts councils are really adept at surveying their region and knowing exactly how many artists and arts organizations are there, and they make their application to us appropriately based on the size of region and the number of artists and organizations. So and the grant is anywhere from $30,000 a year to our smallest region to $150,000 a year, which is the Metropolitan Regional Arts Council and serves this region.
Okay. Okay, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Ms. Benson, I too would like to thank the McKnight Foundation for their contributions in the area of the arts. You had a pamphlet for the Arrowhead region that you kind of held up a little bit. Do you have any of those for like Southeast Minnesota? Or
I have one for every region. I brought this one because it is the region of Madam Chair.
That's a good move. But if you could, for a humble, lowly farm boy from Fillmore County, if you could send me that, I'd really appreciate it. And it'd be the towns like Lanesboro and Harmony and Rushford and the suburb of Lanesboro, which would be Rochester.
Yes.
That area.
So. Right. Madam Chair,
Ms. Fletcher Denson.
The Southeast region is very vibrant, and the region's Arts Council, I can tell you, funds both individual artists through McKnight dollars and then also general operating support for several of its small organizations in the region. But I'd be happy to share with you information.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Benson.
Maybe before February 24th, which is Arts Advocate Day, where so we could be ahead of the people that come to visit us.
That would be helpful.
Yes.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I can work with the 11 regional arts councils to make sure, along with Sheila Smith from MCA and Sue Jens from the State Arts Board, that you have all of that information.
Very good. Very good. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sims, DNR. Sam, is it? Sam.
You seem to be referred to a lot on lots of days that we come to this committee, and so it's good to have a face for you, and if you just briefly tell us a little bit about your programs that you administer, the grant programs that you administer, and what your basic principles are or philosophy is, or what you're told to do.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Wayne Sims with the local grants program at the DNR. I hope the references to me have been positive. But I do work with a number of programs at the department that are aimed at providing grants to local governments. And Kristen mentioned a number of policies that are being adopted statewide for different grant programs. We have really followed those with our local grants programs through the years. Mostly because they, I think, are common sense. You know, most of those policies are things that if you're thinking about providing dollars to local governments or to private organizations, you want to have that level of accountability. You want to have, make sure that the money is being spent properly. So, Actually, one of the reasons I think that in our programs that we have had and we have adopted a number of those policies through the years, and I've worked on this program since the 1980s, so one of the reasons is because we also distribute federal dollars through our program. And one of those programs is the Federal Land and Water Conservation Fund program. That program has actually been around since the 1960s. And in the development of that program, the federal government, of course, wanted to make sure that the dollars were being spent properly. And a lot of these policies that Kristen mentioned are things that had been adopted through the years, probably from experience and maybe from making some mistakes through the years, but a lot of those policies had been adopted decades ago for that program. So maybe to some extent we were fortunate in that we inherited some of those federal guidelines and really applied them to some of the state grants that we've made through the years. We do work with local governments through in my particular programs that I work with, through grants to local parks and regional parks. And then we also have worked with nonprofit organizations through a program we call the Conservation Partner Grant Program. That program originated back in about 1996, I believe, through the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources, now the LCCMR. And so also a number of policies that we use have also sort of been developed through the years in coordination with the LCCMR, working with their staff, because they wanted to have a level of accountability and oversight and monitoring and so forth that they felt would be proper for those types of grants. So I guess I want to mention that the programs I work on are only a small subset of the grant programs within the DNR. I work on about a half a dozen different programs, but there are probably about 50 grant programs within the DNR. And some of those deal with a lot of federal dollars that have their own set of requirements and accountability and so forth. And some of them work with other forms of state dollars, maybe game and fish funds, etc. So I think when Kristen mentioned, there are all types of different grant programs throughout the state, even within the DNR, that is certainly the case. And so I don't want to say that I can speak for all of the DNR grant programs, but I'd be happy to answer any questions about the local grant programs.
Maybe we haven't gotten into it yet, but we appreciate having you visit, and we will perhaps be more prompt to pick up the phone and say, hey, Mr. Sams, what about this?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to try to answer anybody's questions.
Representative Hausman does have a question.
Well, mine isn't a question to the testifier, but more comment after sitting here listening today. And that is this fine line between sufficient oversight and bureaucratic overload, and how quickly you could go from one to the other and lose a lot of the money that taxpayers assumed would go directly to what they were voting for. And it feels very much like a couple of other areas. When I used to still be on K-12 funding, I can recall national conferences where they sort of decried what began to happen with streams of funding and the inefficiency of service delivery then, and the desire that you wished that as much as possible of every dollar would get to the classroom, because that's really why we do education funding. And healthcare, where we have this growing third-party payer system that gobbles up dollars that never get to healthcare delivery system. And I think that that is a challenge, then, that this committee, as we think about this new revenue stream, which isn't all that great, but has to do a lot of work, that it's just so important what we set up to make that happen, or how we write that budget. So anyway, it's just sitting here listening, and remembering all of the conversations I've had in other areas. I think it's a huge caution to us.
And a great reminder of our great responsibility. And what we have to be thinking of when we complete assignment 5 for Monday. Because this is the very beginning. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Minister.
Is anyone from the Minnesota Council on Foundations here? That too was a quick, kind of like speed dating, you know, that we just had some ideas to throw out at the last minute, and we made some phone calls, and some came, some didn't. But in the last few days,
Madam Chair, I haven't had that experience.
but you sound as though you are well informed on that.
Well, we could talk about it at some other time.
Anyway, in the last few days in our mail, we also received Minnesota Council of Foundation mailing, and they too have substantial information in there that could help us do our goals and our indicators of success. If we looked at this before we attempted to do our worksheet. And so I recommend that you find that in your mail. Historical Society.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society, and with me today is David Gravitsky, who is our manager of outreach services. Thank you for the opportunity to tell you a little bit about the grant programs that we operate on behalf of the state. We are a small piece of the big grant picture, and I think we have 3 of the 754 grant programs, a little bit smaller than DNR, but important programs nevertheless. So I think our charge is to give you a quick snapshot of some of the real life programs that we operate. And I've got a handout.
About a 3-minute
okay.
snapshot.
Madam Chair, as you take a look at the handout that's going around, that will describe the grant programs that we operate. And I think it's important to start with the funding sources that these come from. And those are really important to guide us on how we operate those programs. We operate grant programs with state general fund dollars, with bond dollars, and federal dollars. And again, those will point us the case law and statutes and constitutional provisions that have built up over the years guide us on how we administer those programs. I won't spend a lot of time describing each program because it's in the handout, but the general fund state grant and aid goes to county historical societies, most typically, but nonprofit historical organizations around the state. Those are relatively small dollars, and the amount of dollars depend on the applicant pool and the dollars available, which does vary according to the appropriations that you make. On the bond dollars, obviously, those are tied to the restrictions with use of bond funds. They have to be public entities and all the other various restrictions that go with that. As far as process, we, in some cases with a capital budget grant, require a pre-application as well as an application so that we can work with the applicants to make sure that they have a quality application. The application would include a scope of work, which is a detailed description of the work that will be done in the case of building projects. MHS staff review and comment and make recommendations to our grants review committee. And those staff people are experts in their subject area. For example, if it's a building project, the historical architect on staff will review and make comments. If it's an archival or interpretive program request, then staff in those areas will work on that. Written comments are given back to the applicant so that they can, if they're not successful, come back in the future. The grants review committee is made up of members of our governing board, the executive council, as well as members of the public who represent different areas, county historical societies, historic preservation, etc. And then final approval to the grant proposals are made by the executive council, the governing board of the historical society. And then we go into the grant agreement process that was described earlier. As far as criteria, how do we decide on these various grants? The criteria for each of the programs is set out in a grant manual. As you might imagine, the funded grants manual is twice as thick as the general fund grants manual, but these are all available on our website for applicants and others to look at. Our goal is to have statewide distribution, but we do not have formulas for each area of the state, and we depend on what comes in from the applicant pool itself. We typically have a match requirement for the grants, depending on the program, and as I mentioned, there is extensive information on the Historical Society's website. With that, Madam Chair, I will quit and answer any questions that you may have.
Mr. Rybitsky, do you want to say something?
No, Mr. Keller covered the program very, very well. Thank you.
Thank you. It's nice having a face for you, too. Question? Well, you succeeded. Good job.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. And we will hear from you again when you make your presentation, the full presentation for the committee. But
thank you.
You served very well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Representative Mack.
I move approval of the minutes.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Is there anyone in the audience or at the table that wishes to complete assignment 2, even though it's tardy? Anyone come prepared for assignment 2? A lot of people don't have checkoffs for that assignment. Okay, any other comments, questions? This meeting is adjourned.